Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 13, the 1st of May. The 1st of May is a momentous day in our story, as today, Buss's breakout group will embark on the final leg of their epic journey to reach the 12th Army lines. At midnight, the group had reached the forest between the Forsthaus of Mertens Müller and the village of Birkenbrook. The group paused, and they discussed how best to break through to Wenck's lines, now only a few kilometres away. By now, only a handful of tanks were left. They were running on fumes, and they were down to their last rounds of ammo. So in order for the breakout group to actually reach the 12th Army lines, they would have to wait for the right moment before sending up their tanks to smash the final Soviet defences. To attack the wrong section of the Soviet line and have your tanks be destroyed, or take the wrong path and have your tanks run out of fuel, would be catastrophic. Yet, after shedding so much blood in the forests and fields of Brandenburg, the survivors who now stood so close to freedom were not going to give up. Shortly after midnight, the lead German tank started moving, and the rest of the assembled soldiers, officers, and refugees automatically scrambled after them. They found that Soviet resistance around Birkenbrück was surprisingly weak, and it was overcome quickly. The group then moved on to Hennickendorf at 3:30 in the morning, where an anti-tank barrier blocking the road was crushed by one of the few remaining Tigers. The German tanks and vehicles stuck to using the roads, and therefore pushed on through the village of Dobrykow before storming Rieben. The soldiers and civilians, however, made use of the fields and woods to swarm westwards between Rieben and Sauchwitz. From here, they were only a few kilometres from the area between Schönefeld and Wittbrietzen, where it was expected the 12th Army was waiting for them. And in fact, the fighting of the breakout group was loud enough to reach the ears of the 12th Army waiting to receive them. They were that close. SS Sergeant Major Streng described the fighting. Our tanks rolled along the Hennickendorf-Dobrykow road. Halfway along, we came under artillery fire from a copse on the right. Anti-tank guns? We couldn't tell for certain. Suddenly a heavy blow struck our Tiger and the track mudguards fell to the road with a clatter. Our gun roared at the trees some 330 to 400 metres away. There were some bright explosive flashes and branches and treetops whirled into the air. Like lightning came a second direct hit on the hull of our tank. A shell hit the right side of the hull with enormous force and shot upwards. Then followed another frightful bang. We clenched our fists and gritted our teeth. Hit on right side of the turret. Driver, hard left. Quick, go, go, I screamed on the intercom. Our tank reared itself up and rolled left into a field sloping down to a small lake. After going several hundred metres, we turned back to the right. Meanwhile, the other tanks had overcome the Russian anti-tank guns, and the march of thousands continued. Our fuel ran out. Somehow, we got hold of some petrol and drove on. As we were climbing aboard, our tank received a direct hit from half left, across the lake, from a Russian tank standing there that we had not seen. I was wounded in the left upper arm and left thigh. They laid me down inside the tank, which Labour took over. The Wenck army was only a few kilometres away, but here at Wittbrietzen, Rieben and Sauchwitz, the Russian cordon seemed impenetrable. This last section of Soviet-held territory, between Sauchwitz, Dobrykow, Rieben and Wittbrietzen, was criss-crossed in a deadly array of defences, anti-tank barriers and infantry. Plus, to make things worse, the Germans were being harassed by Soviet fighter planes and bombers, leaving untold numbers of dead and wounded. Whilst some parts of this last sector had tree cover, most of it was open field. This meant that for many escapees, the final sprint to freedom was a perilous sprint across open ground, where the Soviet artillery, tanks, and aircraft could literally have a field day. Those precious few remaining tanks the Germans possessed bore the brunt of the Soviet fire, as SS Sergeant Major Streng related in this account. We were feeling quite happy being hopeful of reaching Veng's army during the course of the day. We rolled along the road to Bielitz. Troops came out of the woods and asparagus fields and marched behind us. We sped up. If only we had had better communications inside the tank. Every order had to be shouted. The tank stopped again. An anti-tank gun on the road was swept aside with a blast of high explosive. Half left stood a Russian tank. Armor-piercing! The Tiger's turret turned slowly left. Fire! Hit! Clouds of smoke obscured the view. Suddenly, there was a metallic crack on the tank's right side and a long, drawn-out hissing. A blinding whiteness sprayed in from outside. There was dead silence for a second. We must have overlooked a Russian tank on our right. A white cloud of smoke filled the interior of the tank, and a wave of heat took our breath away. The tank was on fire. Everyone fumbled for the escape hatches to get to the open air. Tongues of bright flame burned our unprotected hands, upper bodies, and faces. Heads and bodies collided with each other as hands unfastened the hot escape hatches. Vital air entered the lungs as racing pulses hammered in the throat and brain. A purplish blackness pierced by green flashes filled my eyes. I grasped the hatch with flying hands, wriggled and thrust myself through, standing on the breech shield and gun. Two heads met in the hatch. I instinctively pulled Leber up and pushed him out of the top of the turret with my head and body. I caught my leather jacket on a hook, ripping it from my body, and it fell back into the burning tank with a final flash of silver from the Iron Cross. I let myself fall head over heels from the 3-meter-high turret, pushing myself away from the sides with my hands as I fell. In falling, I saw that the skin of my left forefinger had been torn loose, so I tugged it off, leaving a bloody something. The burning, reeling figure of the radio operator jumped right in front of me. Hartinger, Neu, and Urs ran past. Was anyone still inside? The tank exploded behind us, the 18-ton turret lifting off and being hurled aside. This was the end. Rudy Lindner also witnessed this event, as he described in his account of his fighting on the 1st of May. We had to cross several open spaces during the night, and each time the infantry and tanks were called forward. There was repeated fighting and shooting. When we had to take cover, we tried to make sure that we five stayed together. With this came great fatigue, hunger, and thirst. We wanted simply to remain lying there with the consequent danger of falling asleep. It cost us much effort to keep forcing ourselves on and stay awake. We avoided the open spaces and tried to remain in the woods, which was not always possible. I am still amazed today that we managed to maintain contact with the leading tanks in this unholy turmoil. Everywhere there was gunfire and cries from the wounded. The dead lay around us as we overcame several enemy positions and cordons. The 12th Army's front line should be immediately behind the last Russian cordon, but would we ever reach it alive? Our leading tank drove out of the woods and was immediately engaged by the Russian anti-tank guns, so it pulled back again. There was now artillery fire on the edge of the woods, and we had to turn south to get away from the road. About 15 minutes later, our last two Tigers attacked out of the woods to the north of us, and a broad stream of soldiers and refugees poured over the open ground to the west and northwest. Unfortunately, as we discovered later, this was the most strongly manned sector of the Russian cordon between Schönefeld and Wittbriezen. The Russians fired flat out with tanks, anti-tank guns, Stalin organs, artillery and mortars on the defenseless people in the open ground. And bombers and ground attack aircraft also joined in. Death struck viciously again and reaped a rich harvest. There was no cover for the soldiers and civilians who were completely exposed to this murderous fire. Mercilessly, the remains of the Ninth Army were being given their death blow only a few hundred meters from the protection of 12th Army's front line. Of the heavy tanks, we now only had Klust's King Tiger from No. 1 Company and Strengs from No. 2 Company. Strang's tank had been hit several times during this decisive breakthrough. Even so, he was still able to engage in a tank duel and knock out three T-34s. But then, his tank was hit by an anti-tank gun and burst into flames. After a dozen severe hits, this time the tank could not be saved. It was the tank that I had been on in Halba, and which had been hit by a phosphorus shell and caught fire there. A few minutes later, SS 2nd Lieutenant Klust's tank was also knocked out, thus writing off the last of the 14 Tiger tanks which 9th Army had sent to join up with the 12th Army. For the first time, I held my four comrades back from attacking, as we had done so often in the last days and weeks. We remained lying at the edge of the woods and watched the course of the uneven fight. It was not fear or cowardice, but military common sense and combat experience that led me to this decision, its correctness being demonstrated only a few minutes later. Given the confusion which reigned over the battlefield, there are many conflicting reports in the sources as to where the final push from the 9th Army was directed, and more specifically, the precise location of where Buss's breakout group linked up with the 12th Army is also unclear. This is because whilst the general bulk of the 9th Army breakout group would punch through in one mass, there were invariably still plenty of other German splinter groups and even individuals who were able to slip across Soviet lines at other points in the sector. So what's important to understand here is that there isn't one magical spot on the map where the link-up moment took place. That said, the core breakout group led by Busse made their final push through a 3-kilometer corridor of fields and forests between Rieben and Salkowitz. This group was aiming for the small village of Schönefeld, just outside of Bielitz. Schönefeld was the closest point in the 12th Army lines, and it was a far more preferable destination because the town of Bielitz itself was still hotly contested between the 12th Army and the Soviets. Bielitz was under heavy bombardment, and the Red Army Air Force was dive-bombing and strafing the town. SS Lieutenant Klust, the King Tiger Tank commander, shares his account of the final push towards Schönefeld. "We approached Schönefeld. The engine of our Tiger tank started spluttering and was about to run out of fuel, but there was none to be had anywhere. Then we learned from some local civilians that there should be some stored at the transmitter south of Schönefeld. So we struggled on there, using the last drops in our fuel tank. We found, as described, a 200-liter barrel and put the contents into our fuel tank. But when the engine started up, Bert Fink, my driver, expressed doubts about the fuel. The engine was running unevenly and kept stopping. Only through my driver's technical skill could our Tiger keep moving. We had to keep the engine hatch open, with a man pulling on a lever. The 12th Army's reception point could not be far off. Thousands of soldiers and civilians were streaming across the open ground to the west. But our tank could not go much further. We received orders again, but orders had little effect anymore. Our Tiger engine gave up, making bubbling noises. We were then told to dig the Tiger in and to use the gun as artillery to cover the remains of the 9th Army. But in view of the situation, I decided otherwise. We made our King Tiger unserviceable and made off to the west with the others. We left our old wreck behind with pangs of regret, for we had fought so many fights together. As the Germans started their final push towards Wenck's lines, the Soviets unleashed a hellfire of tanks, anti-tank guns, Katyusha rockets, artillery, and mortars, cutting the waves of soldiers and civilians to pieces. Ernst Christian Gettke, from the breakout group, shared his story. "The morning of the 1st of May was as cold as the night. We prepared ourselves for the attack with some more ersatz coffee and a few cigarettes. We rolled on towards Bielitz via Arensdorf, Stangenhagen, and Salchowitz. Shortly after Salchowitz, the road emerged from a wood onto open fields, and round a bend to the left, we could see Bielitz ahead of us and hear artillery and infantry fire coming from there. On either side of the road, stragglers were waiting in the ditches for a breach to be forced up ahead. We could see flashes of gunfire coming from Bielitz, and then fountains of earth sprang up around us as the shells exploded, splinters whistling through the air. The breakout group had almost nothing to fight the Soviet barrage with. They possessed almost no artillery of their own, machine guns had run out of ammo, and some units only had a few rounds of mortars left to fire back with. After the nightmarish journey of the last 2 weeks, stretching all the way back to the opening salvos of the Battle of the Zelo Heights, Busse's men were exhausted shells of their former selves. Countless men were carrying horrific injuries, the soldiers and refugees were starving, and no one had slept in days. Busse shouted at anyone who could hear him to keep pushing forward. Fink's men must be waiting for them, only a short distance away. Most were on the verge of collapse, and the ones who did collapse were dragged onto their feet again and shoved towards Fink's lines. They had almost made it, but the Soviet defences were determined not to let them pass. Busse caught up his final remaining tank, which he'd been holding back for the final pivotal moment, and he threw it against the Soviet defenders. The tank ploughed towards the Soviet infantry, causing them to scatter, but it hit rough ground, and for a moment, it stopped. The tank commander, Lieutenant General Wolf Hagemann, looked around in desperation for ammunition which he could fire at the Soviets, but he couldn't find any. Instead, in one last frenzied act, he popped open his hatch and started pumping shotgun shells into the Soviet soldiers, causing them to flee. Suddenly, he heard returning fire. But this time, it wasn't the Soviets doing the firing. It was the guns of Wenck's 12th Army, who were opening the way for Busse's group to rush forward to freedom. Exhausted soldiers and civilians from Busse's group flung themselves into the waiting arms of Wenck's men. The 9th and 12th Armies had finally joined. The moment had come suddenly and unexpectedly, but it was the moment of salvation which the 9th Army had been fighting for. As Wenck later recalled, the men of the 9th were so tired, so worn out, in such terrible shape, that it was unbelievable. He watched in amazement as the huddled masses of the 9th Army poured through his lines. Suddenly, one man broke away from the mass and approached him. He was unshaven and filthy. Not until the man almost reached him did Wenck realize who it was. It was none other than General Busse himself. The two men shook hands, and Wenck simply said, "Thank God you're here." The 12th Army immediately started feeding the soldiers and refugees who had successfully broken through to their lines. Busse, previously described as something of a plump man, was extremely thin by now, and he had no strength left in him. Every available vehicle had been assembled to transport the exhausted survivors west, but some of the 9th Army men had collapsed from the exhaustion and were unable to move. They had to be physically cajoled into the trucks waiting to take them away. Whilst Busse's group has now been saved, other splinter groups from the 9th Army breakout force would find safe passage to Wenck's lines through other points in the sector. One group of only a handful of soldiers included Rudi Lindner. This group had seen the carnage taking place in the area north of Wittbritzen, and they wisely decided to take a route southwest of the town. They darted across the open ground as quickly as they could, and they met 12th Army soldiers at the edge of the woods. Here, they were told to fall in behind them and head for the safety of the nearby railway line. As Rudi himself said afterwards, "We could hardly believe that we had managed to make the last section alive and without having fired a shot. It was only later that we realized how often death had stretched out a finger towards us, in the purest sense, our constant companion, and what enormous luck we had to belong to the few to have survived the fighting on the Oder front, the Hell of Halbe, and the death march to the 12th Army's lines." Another group, which included Ernst Christian Goetke, bypassed Bielitz to the north. Here, the Soviets held a thin line as they had been concentrating most of their forces on the battle raging within Bielitz itself. This group of 9th Army stragglers waited until dark before slipping through the Soviet lines. They moved quickly, silently, and most of all, they made sure to stick together at all times. This group moved in single file towards the Autobahn, and saw that on the far side there was a gap between the road and the nearby woods. They raced across the road and disappeared into the woods on the far side, without being noticed or fired upon. They reached the small town of Borkwalde and saw light coming from the cellar of a house. They entered the cellar, and thankfully, all they found were a few men and women. The men and women explained how the Russians had passed through the town a few days earlier on their march towards Potsdam, but that since then, the town had been occupied by German troops. No Soviet forces had been seen west of the Autobahn since. The group now knew they were safe. The village of Elsholtz, 6 kilometers south of Bielitz, would also be an important crossing point for groups of Ninth Army survivors. Elsholtz was occupied by a Soviet rifle regiment, thus it was a deadly obstacle for the escaping Germans. However, the last 4 Panther tanks from the Kulmark division used their final gasps of fuel to charge the village and force the riflemen into retreat. The tanks could go no further, and they had to be abandoned. But they had forced the way open for the survivors to pour through. Many of the group collapsed in the village due to exhaustion and starvation, and villagers rushed out to share their food with them. The wounded were treated by a doctor from Berlin and a local district nurse, who tried to care for them as best they could. Some splinter groups would not be so lucky, however, and despite the thousands who did successfully escape, many groups were hunted down in the forests over the next few days. Moreover, other groups who were further back in the rear of the breakout group also failed to reach the 12th Army lines. An isolated group of Germans around Luckenwalde, for example, were attacked by the Soviet 117th Guards Rifle Division. And of the 5,000 people in this group, 4,500 were taken prisoner. Other cut-off groups were likewise mopped up by the 3rd Guards Army east of Starkow and by the 28th Army to the east of Krummersdorf-Gut. So now the 9th and 12th Armies have linked up, it's time to ask, how many actually escaped? Putting an accurate number on exactly how many soldiers and civilians managed to reach 12th Army lines on the 1st of May is extremely difficult. This is due to the conflicting sources. And also, in the carnage and chaos, there would have been untold numbers of unidentified refugees caught up in the escape. Busser estimated that at least 40,000 men and several thousand refugees had escaped. Konev, on the other hand, argued that only 3,000 to 4,000 men actually broke through to the 12th Army. It's understandable that Konev would have sought to downplay the number of escapees in order to reduce the embarrassment of having let so many slip through his grasp. So for obvious reasons, we have to take his figure with a pinch of salt. Historians, however, put the number who escaped in the region of around 30,000, consisting of 25,000 soldiers and 5,000 civilians. Whilst these numbers represent a fraction of the Ninth Army's original strength of 200,000 men, they are a significant number nonetheless. And the escape of so many soldiers and civilians represents a remarkable achievement, given the strength of the Soviet forces and the distance the escapees had to travel, mostly on foot. For this fact alone, General Busser, General Wenck, and the men, women, and children of the breakout groups deserve praise. On the 2nd of May, the Ukrainian front reported to Moscow that the 9th Army forces which had broken out of the Hauber pocket, had been eliminated. And with this communication, the story of the flight of the Ninth Army had come to an end. Or had it?